I don't think that you can draw such a direct, thick, straight line from the Russia of Dmitry Medvedev to the decisions that Putin makes in 2014 and 2022. And for the United States, this is the least inevitable of wars, because the last thing that Obama is thinking about when he becomes president in January 2009 is a war between Russia and Ukraine. That would have then seemed like science fiction.
I think it is obvious that NATO expansion does not have any relation with the modernization of the alliance itself or with ensuring security in Europe. On the contrary, it represents a serious provocation that reduces the level of mutual trust. And we have the right to ask, against whom is this expansion intended? That was Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Munich Security Conference in 2007. This speech is often pointed to as the beginning of Putin's modern foreign policy, as he criticized the West and called out NATO as a provocateur. Some in the West, most notably Tucker Carlson, have swallowed this argument hook, line, and sinker, and continue to repeat it today. This week, we spoke to Michael Kimmage, chair of the History Department at Catholic University and author of Collisions, a new book that documents the build-up to all-out war between Russia and Ukraine, and in some ways serves as a great rebuttal to this Russian argument. In his book and in our discussion today, Kimmage takes us through the key moments that led to the invasion of Ukraine by Russia in February 2022, that is, the full invasion of Ukraine by Russia in 2022, as well as the initial invasion in 2014. Collisions is available for sale now and is linked in the show notes. As always, please rate and review Uncommon Decency on whatever platform you use, and send us your comments or questions, either on Twitter at UndecencyPod, I suppose I should probably call it X by now, but you can find us there at UndecencyPod, or by email at undecencypod@gmail.com. We're also continuing our giveaway of the Brexit board game to our patrons, so sign up today for a chance to win that. Thank you, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
So, welcome to another episode of Uncommon Decency. We're delighted this week to have with us a distinguished friend of the podcast, Michael Kimmage. Michael, thank you so much for being with us. Michael, Professor Kimmage is a historian. He's a professor at the Catholic University of America, where he chairs the history department. He's also the chairman of the advisory board of the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, and his writings and research actually cover a wide range of topical areas. You write a lot about U.S.-Russia relations, Professor, the Cold War, history of the Cold War, American diplomatic and intellectual history, all of which will, I think, in one way or another, be relevant to the conversation today. I will remind our audience that you were. Professor Kimmage was last on the show in November 2020. That was over 3 years ago. Back at the time you joined us to discuss your then latest book, which was The Abandonment of the West, back in November 2020. And now you're back to discuss your forthcoming book, Collisions, which will be out later this month with Oxford University Press. So congratulations on this book. And in this book, Professor, in the preface, you do claim, well, this is obviously a history of a war that is still ongoing, and I think a lot of your readers will find that very interesting. Not just that a war that is not just currently unfolding, but also a war that whose end is still very uncertain. And you do sort of explain away, or at least offer a rationale for that. By saying that you do envy future historians who will be able to retrospectively gauge the war's full impact, but you do want to pick up the historian's pen right at the outbreak, in your words, before the guns have fallen silent. So, and on that note, I want to start, Professor, with our first question. You delve into the origins of the war, and you know, in an infamous recent interview, Russian President Vladimir Putin locates the genesis of the current conflict back in the 9th. Century. Where do you think people should start in order to be able to fully understand what's going on in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation to appear on your wonderful podcast and interview program. And it's just such a pleasure to be back with you. I think there are ways, and I'm sure you're the ideal readers in this regard to make the point that there are ways in which The Abandonment of the West, which was a book about the idea of the West and the status of the West in 2020 is a kind of companion volume to Collisions. So Collisions is less idea driven, but it still deals with lots of questions related to East and West and future of Europe, future of the transatlantic relationship. So it's an especial pleasure to bring all of these ideas, you know, sort of back together in this regard. So I can answer your question prosaically. For me, the story begins in 2008, though I think you could also begin in 1991. Certainly, there's quite a bit in my book that goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and to the world that that created in Russia, in Ukraine, in Europe. And I think it's a kind of new United States that also emerges from the end of the Cold War. And, you know, I wouldn't want to travel down too many paths with Vladimir Putin in this regard, given the way that he uses and abuses history. But it's not, okay, you know, ninth century is ludicrous, but it's not wrong, I think, to bring in framings from the 20th century, from the 19th century, and especially when thinking about Ukraine and Russia, even the 17th and 18th century would be relevant, if only to understand the imaginary of figures like Putin. So I wouldn't be completely dismissive of that, although my book begins in 2008. I felt that 2008, it's a slightly arbitrary choice, was sort of the arrival of Dmitry Medvedev in Russia in the late spring of 2008, and then the election of Barack Obama in November of 2008. It seemed like a moment when, you know, you could start to tell a certain kind of story. But what mattered to me as a historian was that I do not think in 2008, the war that we've witnessed, either the 2022 version of it or the 2014 version of it, and they're the same war, I don't think that this was inevitable in 2008. I don't think that you can draw such a direct, thick, straight line from the Russia of Dmitry Medvedev to the decisions that Putin makes in 2014 and 2022. And for the United States, this is the least inevitable of wars, because the last thing that Obama is thinking about when he becomes president in January 2009 is a war between Russia and Ukraine. That would have then seemed like science fiction. So, you know, maybe there were things happening under the surface, subtle things that were inching Russia in the direction of greater conflict, but that was hard to perceive at the time. And it wasn't really symbolized by Dmitry Medvedev. So that seems to me useful, that you have a moment, arguably, but I think to me persuasively, of non-inevitability. And that raises in turn the question of when does it become inevitable, the kind of classic question that historians wrestle about when they think about and they think about wars. And I would see quite a bit of contingency in all of this, that we live in the empire of contingency in this problem set from 2008, when I begin, to February of 2014. And, you know, we'll get into this, I'm sure, later in the discussion. In the interview, I also wouldn't say that 2014 prefigures what happens in 2022. But I think when Putin annexes Crimea, to a great extent, the die is cast. He's crossed a certain kind of threshold. He's entered the territory of another country, a major, sizable European country. He's bitten off a piece. He's celebrated for that in Russia. So it's not like he's politically punished. To the contrary, this kind of creates the new Putinism of 2014. And at the same time, in somewhat more practical, prosaic terms, when Putin takes a piece of Ukraine, he confronts himself with the traditional problem of empires, the traditional problem of growing empires, that the more territory you take, the more territory you need to defend. And so you don't feel secure if you're a Russian military planner looking at Crimea, hard to get water from mainland Ukraine, et cetera. You don't feel secure unless you would have more territory. And that was attempted in the spring of 2014 and, you know, through various kinds of military action, 2014, 2015, it fails. But I think in some crucial way, Crimea does slant and shift and push things in the direction of a wider conflict. So we're now in 2024, we can go back 10 years, and from that we can go back 6 years to what feels to me sort of like the prehistory of this conflict.
Yes, I find it very interesting, the comparison of Obama and Medvedev in the book, especially opening up with that 2008 point. And I think, you know, to most of our listeners, they'll have a lot of familiarity with what the Obama presidency was aiming to do. You very sort of accurately, I think, talked about how the pivot to Asia was a sporting metaphor for the basketball playing president. But I think perhaps one area that certainly was newer to me was getting an understanding of Medvedev's Russia. We sort of typically look at that time as the interregnum between Putin presidencies one and two and sort of dismiss the Medvedev presidency. But there was promise, and you write about this a little bit, with the urbanism and the arrival of luxury shops. But what was it about Medvedev in particular that offered such promise, not just to Russia, but in the way that the West saw Russia when Medvedev became the president?
It's a crucial question. It's really why I wanted to write a history of this period, because I think history allows us to recreate these moments in their own terms. So it is effortless now to go back and say that the Medvedev interregnum was kind of a meaningless, brief episode in Russia, you know, where Russia transitioned from Putin to Putin via this, you know, sort of clownish figure of Medvedev. And that may be a perfectly sustainable argument in retrospect, but it does a disservice to the historical actors at the time who are trying to puzzle through certain things, misreading, misinterpreting, to be sure, idealizing, romanticizing. But it's simply an interesting piece of the puzzle. So as you say, Obama's, you know, sort of familiar with the main lines of his foreign policy. You know, Russia was not for him from 2008 to 2012 the most important of countries, but he did have this kind of basic optimism that a younger generation in Russia, as elsewhere, was going to carry things toward a more democratic, more integrated, globally integrated future. So that's the world that Obama wanted to see, and to a degree, limited, complicated degree, it's the world that Dmitry Medvedev himself represents. So he's trained as a lawyer. He actually has the same law professor that that Putin does in Leningrad. he's not a especially charismatic figure, doesn't have a big personality. He was the sort of improbable manager who emerged in 2008 as Russia's president. But it is startling, on the level of rhetoric at the very least, how much of a westernizer he seemed to be. So his signature project is the creation of a kind of Russian Silicon Valley. He goes to Silicon Valley and opens his Twitter account there at the Twitter offices in San Francisco to sort of great fanfare. And he, as many leaders did at the time, associates geopolitical status with technology, investment, new ideas, youth, capital, etc. And the point of Medvedevism, it could seem, was to bring all that stuff to Russia. And if you look at some of the foreign policy statements, I concentrate on this in the book in some detail, I think it's telling, he's quite receptive to the Arab Spring, or verbally quite receptive to the Arab Spring, where he goes to Davos in 2011 and says, well, when governments are not responsive to the needs of their people, bad things happen, which is, you know, not something that Putin would ever say. You know, in the end, I think I try to slightly overdo that just for dramatic effect, to sort of create this alternative Russia that could have been a somewhat hypothetical story. You know, I think it's very legitimate to say that you could see the deeper structures in Russia underneath Medvedev, which were of Putinist vintage and which prevented him from going very far from the Putinist pattern. But to go back for a moment to your question, you know, I think that what's important about Medvedev in the 4 years that he was in power are all the things that he did not do. So he doesn't stand in the way of a fairly pluralistic, fairly democratic public sphere. You do have NGOs, independent media, maybe not quite independent political parties. I don't think it went that far, but it is Navalny who sort of emerges out of those years and then runs for the mayoralty of Moscow in 2013. And Boris Nemtsov is a, you know, sort of active, not Kremlin-controlled politician at the time. And Russia's two major cities, St. Petersburg and Moscow, really do become, in a number of ways, a part of Europe and a part of the global scene. They're still a part of the global scene. They're no longer a part of Europe. But you could deceive yourself, perhaps, or just have the experience of going from London to Moscow at the time and feeling like you're really in you know, sort of a continuous cultural zone or cultural space. And I don't think that that's Medvedev's creation. He didn't care about that stuff, but he doesn't prevent it from happening. So it's a vibrant period in Russian life, a kind of interesting period, fair amount of intellectual, cultural ferment. But none of that is going to prove decisive when Putin returns to power in 2012. So to that degree, the standard interpretation of this period as a somewhat superficial interregnum is the correct interpretation. But I try to dramatize and make that a little bit less intuitive for my readers, just to just keep them on their toes, I suppose.
A little bit superficial, but with one very momentous decision on the foreign policy front from Medvedev, and you alluded to it in your last answer, talking about the Arab Spring. But with regard to Libya, which the US intervened with a NATO force, and Russia abstained at the Security Council. And this was a decision that Medvedev made and Putin disagreed with. Could you talk us through the Russian perspective on that decision? Because we hear a lot of regret. Obama's called it the biggest mistake of his presidency. And we've seen some regret from European leaders who were involved in that one. But we don't hear as much about the Russian view of, A, the decision to abstain, and then the aftermath too.
It's very crucial. It's a real kind of turning point in Russia. You could probably overinterpret it and say it's one of the reasons that Putin returns to power in 2012. I think Putin tries to present it that way. That's an overinterpretation, because I think Putin planned to come back regardless. But still, it's sort of associated with that transitional moment. I think the way to see it on the Russian side is in a continuum. And this is the most rational explanation of Russia's 2014 and 2022 invasion of Ukraine. I will emphasize, not a justification of these invasions, but a rational explanation for why there's a kind of strategic logic beyond, you know, the impulsiveness of Putin or just the whims of Putin as a political leader. So the continuum takes us back to the Balkans and to Yugoslavia in the 1990s and to the then widespread Russian outrage of elite foreign policymaking Russians, outrage that NATO had overstepped its bounds. So NATO is created as not NATO enlargement in this case, but it's NATO as a defensive military alliance built around the notion of deterrence, a kind of Cold War structure, and yet it's NATO that's involved in a bombing campaign in Serbia. So it's not just that Russians had an affection for Serbia, which is of historical vintage, it's that NATO is newly active. It's sort of acting out of area. And that's really upsetting to Russians in Europe, because they feel like they've truly lost a high degree of decision-making power in Europe. And, you know, it's hard to say that that assessment is wrong, really. The second point on the continuum is the Iraq War. And not only does Putin disagree with the Iraq War and feel that it's a mistake and that it ruins a lot of Russian economic relationships with Iraq, but it also diminishes the value of Russia's UN Security Council veto. So this is the prestige object that Russia emerges from the Cold War with, this prestige object still in its hands, and Russia is unable to prevent the invasion of Iraq at the UN Security Council. And so these are two ways in which Russian power was eroding globally. It's a Russian assessment, but I think it's pretty close to fact. And of course, the NATO campaign in Libya comes as the sort of third and maybe most radical point on the continuum, because you have this abstention on the part of Russia. Now, what Medvedev was thinking about that abstention, I wish I knew. It's a grim fact for those of us who are Russia watchers and write about this country that we often do so without real evidence. So, you know, I can't really say what Medvedev was thinking, but my guess is that he was trying to win a certain amount of goodwill, because he did appreciate the relationship he had with Obama, and I think he found it to be useful for Russia. It gave Russia a certain standing in the world. It gave Russia certain economic options. And how costly would it be to abstain from this particular decision? But it really does haunt Medvedev, or in a way undermine him, because he abstains for what he thought would be a fairly modest bombing campaign. Instead, you know, sort of the campaign does topple the government of Libya, and then you have the death of Gaddafi. And, you know, the sort of violence of that, the overthrow. And so then this becomes a kind of Russian narrative of color revolution. So for Putin, for critics of Medvedev, for this abstention, it's not just the abstention that matters. It's as if Russia is giving in to this trend going back to the Balkans in the 1990s that is pulling the rug out from Russia as a global power. So it's you know, that sounds maybe a bit melodramatic, but I think it did have that significance in Moscow at the time. And of course, this is 2011. Putin is back in 2012. The commotion in Ukraine for Russia begins November 2013. So these are all quite close in sequence, these data points.
Thank you. Professor, having sort of addressed very early from the get-go of this conversation, this question of inevitability, which I think is on a lot of people's minds out here, and especially sort of non-specialist share of our interested audience will just, you know, jump straight into one of the anecdotes you recount in the book that, that we found were really interesting, which is when right in the preface, you recount this, this meeting you had in January 2016, when you, you show up at the residence of the U.S. ambassador in Kiev with a number of your Ukrainian interlocutors. And you were, at the time, you were too, and actually, I forgot to mention this in the introduction we did 3 years ago. You also, in addition to your scholarly activities, you served in government. And at the time, you were 2 years into your role then at the U.S. State Department's Office of Policy Planning. And it was January 2016, and you do highlight that that Donald J. Trump hadn't yet been nominated as the Republican candidate for that year's election, but you claim that you know you were very impacted by in your words the curiosity, the decency, and the idealism of the young Ukrainian civil society leaders that you met, and in some sense, all of these years later, when you write this book, you're still haunted by what you saw there. And you even connect it to sort of this Tocquevillian notion of civil associations that you saw perhaps even more alive in Ukraine than I think we can see it in parts of the West. And my question to you would be, you know, what's the role of these young voices, these idealist voices, in the global imaginary around the war? Do you feel that these voices of young pro-Western minded Ukrainian civic leaders are being drowned out when we're discussing these wars, that they're being sort of sidelined and left behind?
Well, it's a wonderful question and very dear to my heart. I'll just mention one other detail about the group that I met with that left the greatest impression. We did meet with, you know, Mayor Klitschko and former president of Ukraine, Kuchma, and then Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, and those were all interesting meetings, but I don't remember a word that was exchanged in those most sort of fairly official meetings. And then the embassy set up, a fairly informal conversation with students from Kiev Mohyla Academy and Taras Shevchenko University. These are the two elite universities in Kiev. And I was a little bit amused by it at the time because, we started to talk about Tocqueville and democracy, and I felt like we were almost caricatures of American diplomats. But that amusement, sort of vanished when I heard the Ukrainian students speak, the kind of candor, the sincerity, the, you know, deep intelligence, the desire to really understand in philosophical terms what democracy is, what a civil society is. It was above and beyond, most of those conversations that I've had anywhere. I stayed in touch with those students by email, but then when you leave the State Department, you no longer have your email. So all of the addresses have vanished into the ether of the U.S. government records. And so I'm not able to follow up and keep in touch. And that's in part what haunts me about these young people, because I'm sure all of them, they did seem to be mostly men, but that's not material, really. All of them, I'm sure, are at the front or near or in some way involved in the war effort. What they wanted to ask about, and it was again, sort of intellectually touching, was voluntary associations. Tocqueville's notion about this social underpinning of democracy, and they really were thinking it through, and they had been on the Maidan only 2 years before, which was itself a kind of overgrown voluntary association. And you could say there's a lot that's then and now ugly about Ukrainian politics, but this is the best of it. The sort of the best spirit there. It has been remarked upon by many people, and I mentioned this in the preface, that one of the reasons the war effort has succeeded in Ukraine is that there are a lot of voluntary associations driving it. There are communities that are putting together, you know, sort of uniforms and food packets and such. And so in this sense, to go back to your question, I think that that spirit is sort of in evidence and is remarked upon. I think it's one of the things that people admire when they admire Ukraine, that it's not just, you know, Zelensky who's fighting the war, but there's a, you know, sort of strong pyramid beneath him. But, you know, I wouldn't want to be too rosy-eyed or romantic. The problem with wars is that they wash away a lot of these kinds of things just by what they are. They get washed away by fear. They get washed away by deprivation. Get washed away by the fact that these young idealistic students who could be running NGOs, you know, might be doing things at the front instead. So I think that this is still visible, this aspect of Ukraine, even though the war has come so much into the foreground. But I think it would be wrong not to worry about the future of this in Ukraine, not because the Ukrainians have dissipated the promise of these young people, but because the war, and I think this is a conscious effort on Putin's part, the war is there to break apart Ukrainian society. And we can't say with confidence that this is not gonna happen. So it's with that I'm sort of haunted by these figures, and I just so much wish that I could reconnect with them and get a sense of where they've gone in the last, what would it be, the last 8 years. But, clearly there are sort of moments when you travel and you kind of glimpse a country's future. And I felt like that was one of those moments for me.
As the war progresses, do you think the views of Ukrainians, not just those who are in the high levels of civil society, but the public at large, will become more idealistic and more embracing of some of those values that you spoke of? Or do you think war will create a harder edge to society? I know that's a very difficult question to answer, but what's your sense in terms of the way the conflict is shaping civic values?
I think that the trend will run in two separate directions, that the level of sacrifice in Ukraine is so high that what it's going to do for the foreseeable future is to sort of enshrine the ideal of sacrifice. And in that sense, it's quite possible that, you know, these were young people who were kind of looking at different job options. They were finishing university, very talented, very, very bright. And they were kind of thinking through, well, maybe I'll go work for the Ministry of Finance, or maybe I'll go work for an NGO. And they were sort of had voluntary associations on their mind for that reason. That's not trivial. That's not unimportant. But that pales by comparison, I think, with the kinds of sacrifices now that are being made. And so I think that there is a kind of heroic light that's going to shine in Ukrainian society because of this war, however it concludes. And maybe it will sort of carry further this spirit than it would have been carried without the war. But the other direction in which things will trend is, I think, the direction of just about every wartime society, that wars concentrate executive power at the top, which is the opposite of what Tocqueville was trying to get at in his great book of the 1830s. Zelensky, there are many things to admire in Zelensky, but there are a few authoritarian tendencies in that man. There's not going to be an election this year because of martial law in Ukraine. I think that he's clamped down quite a bit on media freedom. And so that's one trend line that we have to follow carefully. And what wars also leave as their legacy, we can think back to the First World War in this regard, is the legacy of hatred. And hatred is an illiberal emotion. You know, it places people into categories and builds up animosities. It's not, I would say, the fault of Ukrainians that they feel this hatred. It's a consequence of the war, but it's probably not going to improve Ukrainian politics, and it's going to make it more difficult to manage. We could, of course, spend a lot of time on more practical elements of political economy, you know, the demography of the country, how many people have been forced out, how viable the economy is, its dependence on outside support. And these two are also very worrisome circumstances that are going to be difficult to resolve through, you know, civic activism and the entrepreneurial spirit of individuals. So the war is, in this regard, and it feels to me sort of self-evident to say this, but and a little bit hard at the same time, but necessary to say, the war is going to be an unbelievable burden for this society, of a kind that we couldn't have imagined or pictured when we had our conversation back in Kiev in January of 2016.
And now, one of the mental models that I think historians of war, and in some ways, you're a historian of war, but the mental model that even the public at large uses to analyze these bellicose dynamics is the Peloponnesian War, and you claim in the preface that Tucydides's rationale for explaining that war one power fearing another, but you do say that the Peloponnesian War anticipates, or in some ways illuminates or helps understand the Ukrainian war, but just in not the same way that most people would think. You write that Russia did not precisely fear the growth of Ukrainian power in 2022, rather it feared its alignment or Ukraine's alignment with Western power. It's not that it couldn't grow powerful, was that power was heading in the wrong direction. Now, do you think, obviously, looking at the long term, and you've already given us some hints towards this answer, but do you think that Vladimir Putin's, not to say Russia, but Vladimir Putin's ambition, and it's a murderous ambition, but his ambition to wrestle Ukraine away from the orbit of the West, is it sustainable? Is it even achievable in the long run?
I find this very difficult to ascertain. I'll go back to the Thucydides inflected, you know, argument or thesis of the book, and then try to get to a assessment of your crucially important question as to whether Putin and Russia can succeed in the war that they're fighting, focusing a little bit more on their terms maybe than on ours, because maybe that helps us to understand what success might look like in Moscow. So one of the things that I could never quite piece together in this book, and you know, I sort of try to weave it together as best I can, but I don't think it fully coheres, is in part the classic Thucydides notion of fear, and revised exactly along the lines that you're describing. It wasn't that Ukraine was growing so strong that Russia feared an invasion from Ukraine. It was this gradual alignment of Ukraine with the West, institutionally, militarily, economically, et cetera. And that is a reality after 2014, that Ukraine's government wishes to be of Europe and of the transatlantic relationship. And that's a progression from 2014 to 2022. And, you know, there is, it's hard for us to understand this, I think, because we maybe think of ourselves as relatively benign, but there is fear that this generates in Moscow. And the war is in part an outgrowth or a reflection of that fear. But what makes it, I think, confounding and maybe even contradictory is that I think Putin feels a lot of contempt for the West. And yes, there's true fear of the military power, but there's a kind of dismissiveness or real contempt, even, you know, sort of hatred. And so it's not so much arguments about Western decadence. Those, I think, are Russian media fabrications. But, you know, going back to the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, you know, turbulence in American domestic politics, I think Putin looked at the West circa 2021, 2022 and said, this is the moment to strike, not just because we might lose Ukraine, but because the West is in a kind of disarray. You know, I don't think that he was correct in this judgment. I think in some ways it was one of his biggest mistakes when it came to the decision to invade. But I think this is the emotion that informs his decision to invade. And I don't recall Thucydides writing about contempt, but maybe I have to go back and look at the book more closely. But the fear part is what Thucydides helped me with. I think it's impossible for Russia to conquer all of Ukraine. There's no way that it can take the territory. It's an enormous country, and its will to resist is too great. I think it's probable that Russia will not even be able to successfully, in quotation marks, partition the country, because what Russia needs at the present moment, by its standard of argument, by its the strategic case it has made or appears to have made, Russia's going to need to take a few more Ukrainian cities. Okay, ideally they would like to take Kiev, but I think that that's you know, very, very unlikely for them. But even a medium-sized city, we could go back to the city of Kherson that the Russians took at the beginning of the war, and then they lost it. For them to take Kherson now, I think very, very difficult. It's amazing in a certain way, if you just think in very basic military terms, that Russia cannot take the city of Kharkiv. It's 30, 40 miles from the Russian border. You know, it's a city of, you know, I know Putin thinks this way and the world works differently, but it's a city, in quotation mark, of ethnic Russians, and certainly it was before the war a city of Russian speakers. And so it should have been a city that by Putin's logic would have fallen into Russia's lap, and it hasn't. What has Russia done over the last couple of months? They've spent, I don't know, 10,000, 30,000 lives, estimates differ, on taking the city of Avdiivka, which was 30,000 people before the war. So that's a mathematical state of affairs that means that the war is a very, very steep climb for Russia. But, you know, the hopes that they hold out are about the West cracking, you know, loss of support, Ukrainian society somehow falling apart. And in those scenarios, I think that they believe they can still win. I wouldn't dismiss those 100%. You know, there are lots of contingencies in all of this. But I think Putin has set Russia an impossible task. Impossible because of Ukraine, impossible because of the West, and impossible because Russia's own military capacity is not what Putin thought it was on the eve of invasion. I struggle not to engage in wishful thinking and I worry a little bit about this argument in that regard. But this is how I see it at the moment.
Michael is out. Jorge and myself here, ready to discuss our conversation, but also the book as well. And Jorge, thank you so much for connecting us with Michael. I know you've known him for a couple of years. This is my first time meeting him, but a very, very insightful conversation and a really, really great book that we encourage you all to order. And it will be in the show notes, so you can get a link to get to Michael's book.
So, Julian, what did you, obviously you've, I think, really driven in some ways our coverage, our show's coverage of the war. You've been commenting a lot on sort of the U.S. dimension and the military aid. Are you what has Professor Kimmage brought, you think, to the show in terms of helping us understand a little bit about the dynamics? We ended with sort of, you know, forward-looking node, what's going to happen, how's this going to, you know, negotiations, containment, how's this going to eventually unwind? What do you think? Are you more optimistic after this conversation?
I think there are two elements that I sort of consider on it. So I think the first one relates to Ukraine's war prospects, which is the immediate concern for a lot of people observing the conflict closely, the fact that they're running low on ammunition. The Russians are firing more shells per day than the Ukrainians can because they just don't have the arms. And in a lot of the media coverage, we get lost in the details of, are we supplying F-16s? Why haven't we supplied an A-10? Why isn't the Taurus going? Why aren't the tanks going? And the simplest answer is that Ukraine uses a lot of Soviet era equipment. And the easiest way to support them would be by ramping up production of those armaments. Now, obviously, the number of factories that still produce them is quite limited, but Germany, its proximity, can absolutely play a role there. And in some ways, I'm more optimistic because the solutions are simpler than I think a lot of the commentary makes out. So when we talk about, you know, supplying F-16s, there's a dimension of training pilots, supplying arms, supplying repair equipment, integrating systems, all of which is complex and difficult to do. But ramping up production at factories to provide more shells is a far simpler process, but one that seemingly isn't being done because of a lack of long-term vision from leaders in Europe and the United States to provide large quantities of those armaments and to ramp up production, not only to meet demand from Ukraine, but also for future force preparation, given Russia's and indeed other conflicts around the world that might happen in the future. That's a very simple one, and I think a cause for optimism if you're hopeful of action from leaders is that the solutions are a little bit simpler than some of the commentary might suggest. I think the other thing that I really, really appreciated Professor Kimmage stating at the end, which is him talking about containment and reverting back to a sort of Cold War realist strategy, because President Macron got in a lot of trouble at the outset of the conflict. A, for trying to talk Putin down, and then B, for saying, you know, we need to figure out, you know, what's a plan for us to work with Russia once this war is done. And I think Kimmage rightly points out that there is no working with Putin, really, because his goals are one, he's fighting a war of annihilation, and there's no real counterparty to that other than to utterly reject the objective of annihilation of Ukraine as a state and indeed its people. And I think Kimmage pointing that out is very important as a reminder that the end goal for this is or needs to be a Russian defeat, and specifically a defeat of Putin's core goal of annihilating the Ukrainian state. In terms of his assessment of what does this look like after that, which might, and, you know, he pointed out it could be a decade hence, you know, Putin is going to win another 6-year term, and that means we're looking at 2030 until the next time where he might be either retiring or moving away, but obviously retirement doesn't really look like an option for Putin inside Russia. And I think that the notion of adopting the realist doctrine of containment, as was the case in the Cold War, and not relying on war fighting to limit Russia's adventurism abroad, but just to contain it through careful alliances, careful strategies, careful structures, I think that's a more realistic And also, I think in some ways, upbeat vision of the future rather than a Manichaean sort of division of the world between the Russian sphere and the Western sphere. You can adopt a strategy of containment that's focused on engagement with countries who do see Russia as a threat, but it's about, you know, rather than making it an us versus them thing, you can sort of be a bit more proactive in the outreach. And I think that's an important thing that you pointed out. What to you, I sort of hear your thoughts on this, like what stood out to you both from your reading of the book, but also from his talk today? And I think some of the elements on Ukrainian society that I know you and I spoke about offline were quite appealing to you. What were your main takeaways?
So I was actually really struck, as far as I understood, and I seem to have understood, this may have been sort of a distorted framing, but it seems like when, you know, Professor Kimmich, you know, I think he's not just a scholar, he's also a policy planner. I think in the U.S. jargon, he's someone who's gotten used actually for up until he returned to academia. I forget exactly which year, but he does recount in 2016 when he's still in the Office of Policy Planning at the State Department, and he arrives in this sort of very leafy suburb of Kiev, and he sits down with these civil society actors, these very young idealistic Ukrainian leaders, and he in a way what I seem to infer is that he's actually seeing America in the 19th century with this self-drive and this understanding of self-government as something that starts locally and sort of is a bottom-up process. And so that's kind of, I think, where we went in with our question is sort of, you know, where is that now? I mean, what's the role of that in the war? Because it does seem, I mean, there was quite recently, just a couple of weeks ago, I was at the airport and I picked up a copy of Le Nouvel Observateur, which is a very nice center-left leaning French magazine. And their cover was, their whole issue was actually about Ukrainian poets, authors, artists, who actually say themselves that they feel forgotten. They feel like their narrative and the way they're transmitting the pain and the sense of abandonment and the sense of anguish of the Ukrainian population isn't really being sort of channeled into. And I feel like we're out here in the West and Western Europe, certainly, and also in the U.S., where we tend to I think it has to do with war fatigue, but it also has to do with remoteness, right? Geographical remoteness, language barriers. We've kind of forgotten these narratives and I think war really shapes the culture of a nation and I think unless the Ukrainian diaspora plays a role in your local politics or in your local cities, which by the way in Spain it totally doesn't, they're very invisible. I mean, it's actually a little tragic how these Ukrainian exiles are gathering on a daily basis in downtown Madrid and so many other cities in Western Europe, and they're very few actually, and they're people kind of walk by them and they're very indifferent, I think, and we've grown, I think, numbed. So I think Professor Kimmich has this sensitivity through his connections, through his experience, and that's one of the things that touched me the most. So it's not just a history of the diplomatic origins of the conflict. I think it's also a history of its impact on society and how Ukrainian society has lived through it.
Yeah, and I really like that, how he describes it as a first attempt at a first draft of the history of the conflict and tracing it back to 2008. And it's very interesting to sort of reflect back on what we thought then and where we are now. And, you know, one thing we didn't get to touch on today, but is sort of where the conflict goes next. In some ways, the war between Russia and Ukraine is already going global, not just from outside involvement, but now with the situation in Sudan, where Ukrainian forces are fighting Russian forces in a civil war in another country. It's very cold war, but between two neighbors in Eastern Europe. Michael Kimmich's book is, well, by the time this is published, I think it'll be available for pre-order, if not for order. Collisions is the name of the book. We will link to it in the show notes so that you can access it easily. If you would like to review the book, we encourage you to do so. We will be reviewing the book because we both managed to get early copies. So thank you to the publishers for gracing us with that. If you'd like to get more Uncommon Decency, you can like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter, which is where we put out most of our content, including little teasers for upcoming episodes, little clips, and general engagement with the audience. And then the last thing that I have to promote is, of course, our Patreon. So we had a slightly more extended conversation with Michael today, and that is available for our Patreon subscribers. And we have some very exciting episodes coming up on a lot of key issues, including one on artificial intelligence. And if you would like to get access to the full length interviews, we encourage you to subscribe to our Patreon for the low cost of €5 a month. I think euros is the currency we're using, but five of whichever your primary currency is, as long as it's one of the big three of dollar, euros, or sterling. Jorge, thank you so much for setting this episode up. Always a pleasure to see you, and thank you so much for getting Michael onto the podcast to talk about his new book.
Thank you for doing this, Julian. Thank you, everyone. See you on the next episode.